Welcome to Biz News Daybreak. This is Monday, the 16th of March, 2026. I'm Alec Hogg. Here's the sharp, actionable news you need to stay ahead today. Let's get straight into it. Well, the oil price has edged a little higher this morning, $104 a barrel. That's the Brent crude price. Gold is under a little bit of pressure. That's just over $5,000 an ounce. And that has affected the South African rand, which is starting the day at 16.84 against the US dollar. That's down by 3% on the past week. The rand, as is gold. So it just shows how the two of them are really working in parallel now. Bitcoin had a good session over the weekend. 2% higher starts the week at just under $73,000 per Bitcoin. Before we get into the other news, let me just bring you up to date on the market movements. While we were busy with the Biz News conference, Sasol was screaming ahead. It's up 17% in the past week and is now trading, well, pretty close to 200 Rand a share, finishing on Friday at 192 Rand a share, a jump of 12% on Friday. This on the stronger oil price. On Wall Street, both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ fell a little on Friday, around about 0.5% to 1%, the two of those. And that was reflecting some declines in some of the big stocks. We're going to hear more about the tech stocks in today's show and why they could be providing a safe haven, believe it, for the war. But they didn't do so on Friday. Meta was down by just about 4%, Apple by 2%, and Nvidia 1.5%. But let's get on to the freshest overnight news, where US President Donald Trump wants his NATO allies to join in the war against Iran. Here's the team at Bloomberg News now.
The U.S. struck military sites on Karg Island over the weekend. This is Iran's main export hub for crude oil. Then late on Sunday, President Trump told the Financial Times the U.S. was prepared to launch new strikes on Karg Island. He also said the U.S. could target Iranian oil infrastructure. And at the same time, Trump stepped up calls to U.S. allies to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Here is Trump speaking later to reporters aboard Air Force One.
I would really up demanding that these countries come in and protect their own territory, because it is their territory. It's the place from which they get their energy, and they should come and they should help us protect it. You could make the case that maybe we shouldn't be there at all, because we don't need it. We have a lot of oil. We were the number one producer anywhere in the world times two.
Trump also told the Financial Times that NATO faces a very bad future if U.S. allies fail to assist in opening up the Strait of Hormuz. On top of that, Trump also said he could delay his summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping later this month as Trump presses Beijing to help unblock the strait. And in the same exchange with reporters, Trump said Cuba wants to make a deal with the U.S., but he wants to finish war with Iran before turning to the island nation. It's the third week of war with Iran, and President Trump says Tehran is ready to make a deal to end the war, but the U.S. wants better terms. However, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Harachi, said the Islamic Republic has not asked for talks or a ceasefire. Here is Harachi speaking with CBS Face the Nation.
No, we never asked for a ceasefire, and we have never asked even for negotiation. We are ready to defend ourselves as long as it takes. And this is what we have done so far, and we continue to do that until President Trump comes to the point that this is an illegal war with no victory.
That is Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Harachi speaking with CBS Face the Nation. Meantime, several officials from the Trump administration are signaling the war may last several more weeks. Here is NEC Director Kevin Hassett speaking on CBS Face the Nation.
We expect that the global economy is going to have a big positive shock as soon as this is over, and we're still being briefed that it would be 4 to 6 weeks from the beginning and that we're ahead of schedule.
That is NEC Director Kevin Hassett speaking on CBS Face the Nation. Now, the energy shock has forced investors to reassess a broad array of industries, from food delivery firms to cosmetics makers. And it will also impact the meeting of Fed policymakers later this week. We have a preview from Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett.
Fed officials are widely expected to hold rates steady, and traders will be focusing on any potential change in the central bank's outlook to incorporate the impacts of the war. According to a Bloomberg News survey, economists have pushed back their expectation for the Fed's next interest rate cut to June from March, but still see 2-quarter-point reductions by year-end. Nearly a third of economists polled also expressed misgivings about Kevin Warsh, the former Fed governor tapped by President Trump to succeed Chair Jay Powell in New York. Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
From time to time, we engage with Josh Meservey from the Hudson Institute in Washington, one of the top think tanks there. Well, over the weekend, our partners at Bloomberg sat down with Josh's colleague, retired Colonel Joel Rayburn, who worked in the Trump administration during Trump's first term and is familiar with a 15-year-old plan to attack Iran. His assessment of what's happened now compared with what was planned is fascinating.
Colonel, since, as you're saying, this plan did exist during the first term, how closely is this administration's action following that plan, and what comes next?
It's so much more advanced. I mean, as someone who was formerly familiar with an earlier version of that plan, the military technology advances just in the 15 years or so since I was involved in that sort of thing are just astonishing. And the military imbalance between the U.S. and Israel on one side and the Iranian regime on the other is far wider than CENTCOM would have enjoyed back then under General Abizay, General Petraeus, and so on. It's if you had told me in 2009 that 2 weeks into this campaign plan, the Iranian leadership would be decimated, their ballistic missiles would be down by over 90%, their drones down by over 90%, they would have no operable air force, navy, missile defense, and air defense, I'd have told you you were smoking something. But it's just astonishing the military progress that's being made at an operational level.
You talk about the military progress made. The president sat down with Brian Kilmeade on his radio show a little earlier this week and talked about what an endgame might look like. Let's take a listen to what he had to say to Brian Kilmeade.
We had the greatest economy in history. We still do. Oh, this will bounce right back. When it's over, and I don't think it's going to be long, when it's over, this is going to bounce right back so fast.
When are you going to know when it's over?
When I feel it.
Okay.
I feel it in my bones.
Your sense from your experience in the first term and from what you've observed here over the last few weeks of what the endgame is likely to be here and what the timeline this administration is working with.
Well, there's a military end game. There's a military end state that's very clear. There's a political end state that's something different. On the military side, the objectives that they laid out, the president, Secretary Rubio, at the beginning of eliminating the nuclear program, ballistic missile and drone program, the ability for the Iranian regime to use terrorist proxies outside their borders, those are all well on their way to being accomplished. And then the further phase of essentially eliminating the Iranian regime's production capacity to be able to regenerate those kind of things if there is a cessation of hostilities with an Iranian regime still there in place. Now, the political end state is still unclear. And it seems to me, as I was a staffer for President Trump, we all know the president is someone who likes to keep his strategic options open. He enjoys strategic ambiguity because it gives him leverage in negotiating outcomes. And I think he's still doing that here. Whether he's willing to tolerate an end of campaign with a rump Iranian regime still in place, but greatly weakened with lacking the capacity to go on into the future, is something he's keeping that option open. That creates confusion on the Iranian regime side, I think, that actually hinders their ability to respond, which is what you want.
Back on the local front, and while the U.S. Ambassador Brent Bozell attracted most of the attention from our BizNews conference, he was also only one of many newsmakers to grace the BNC 8 podium over those 3 full days of brain food. We will be publishing all of those keynotes and the Q&A sessions over the next few weeks. Economist Darby Ruart kicks us off. He was in typical truth bombing form, arguing that an overpaid, parasitic civil service is actively bankrupting South Africa. What I found strange was that Ruart didn't hold back, despite the fact that the chairman of Eskom was in the room, having also delivered a keynote a little earlier.
The real estate capture in South Africa are the civil servants and the entrepreneurs, where they are totally and completely overpaid. That is not all. If you analyze the numbers of GDP yesterday, one of the categories, the second worst category in South Africa, is a category called electricity, gas and water, which contracted last year by 4.3%. And the biggest contributor to that is Eskom. Eskom prices will increase by 9% or up to 12%, while inflation target is 3%. That means all of you must get well below 3% in order to get inflation to 3%. How on earth do we allow a mismanaged company like Eskom and Transnet and the post office to get above, well above inflation increases? I'm very sorry about the chairman of Eskom last year. His salary last year, he is not a chairman. He is a civil servant working for a company that belongs to the state, that belongs to the people of South Africa. He thinks he's a chairman. He thinks he works for a company. They think they have a board and a CEO. They don't have that. It's only in name. The CEO of Eskom got paid 13 million rand per year. How on earth can I pay civil servants 13 million rand per year? We can't do that. The same goes for Transnet, 8 million rand per year that we pay the civils. And that debt of Eskom, 350 billion rand. And the debt of Transnet, 150 billion rand. And the debt that the local authorities owes to Eskom, in excess of 100 billion rand, that's all debt that should be included with the Minister of Finance to get the real picture of what's going on the state's finances. And it's time that us, the taxpayers, stand up and say, genoeg is genoeg.
Well, onto that tech stock story now. And the question that we need to ask is, could U.S. tech stocks be a surprisingly safe bet? Mark Filippino, host of the FT News Briefing, spoke to Emily Herbert, who covers markets for the FT. And Emily explains how the ongoing conflict has driven a rush into Silicon Valley, but with some very big caveats.
Investors had been fleeing from tech stocks lately. There was concern that they were forming a bubble and vulnerable to a crash. But now, kind of weirdly, investors are viewing American tech stocks as a safe haven asset because they're protected from the turmoil of the war in Iran. Here to talk more about this head scratcher is the FT's Emily Herbert. Hey, Emily.
Hey, Mark.
So just how dramatic is this rush back into tech stocks?
The numbers aren't massive. But what is quite striking is that the tech sector is the only sector in the S&P 500 that's actually gone up since the conflict began. So tech stocks within the S&P 500 are up about 1.5% since the beginning of the conflict in the Middle East, whereas the rest of the S&P is down almost 3% and every other sector is down.
Emily, I got to tell you, I got a little chuckle when I read your story, because we've talked to you and so many of your colleagues about investors selling off tech stocks this year because they were viewing them as increasingly risky. But now these equities are a safe haven asset. What's going on?
Yeah, so a few investors did say to us this week that they're starting to think about some of these big US tech stocks kind of like safe havens now. I mean, I think there's a sense of, at least we know that these companies have got their massive balance sheets, they've got these big profits, they've got loads of cash. And yes, there are lots of things about these tech stocks that the market was really worrying about before the conflict. There were big worries about how much money was being spent, about whether these AI companies were going to disrupt business models in the rest of the market. But I think there is probably a sense now of, yes, these are all still things to worry about, but I suppose they're more on a kind of 5 or 10 year horizon rather than maybe a 5 or 10 minute horizon. So yeah, some of these tech stocks are starting to look a little bit less risky than some other kind of big industrial or materials companies that are going to be really affected by high oil prices and high energy costs if the war continues.
What about actual safe havens? You know, things like gold and sovereign bonds, how are they doing?
Yeah, I think part of the reason that tech stocks have been so popular in this conflict is because the normal safe havens aren't really working. Because the main channel for investors here is the energy price and the oil price, this is seen as an inflationary shock, and inflationary shocks are really bad for government bonds, which would normally be a safe haven in any other shock. So government bond prices have really dropped and yields have gone much higher, which is causing a big problem for governments as their borrowing costs go up. Gold, which had also been a safe haven earlier in the year, has also dipped a bit. There's a sense there that investors are having to just sell what they had lots of in order to cover losses elsewhere, perhaps. And gold is definitely something that investors had a lot of going into this conflict.
Emily, could this rush into tech come back to bite traders?
There is definitely a sense that this could come back to bite traders, especially in the case that maybe the conflict wraps up in a shorter time frame, in more like days compared to weeks or months, because the things that people were worrying about before haven't gone away. And I think that if the conflict does come to an end sooner, then things like AI disruption and CapEx spending will come back into the foreground for investors. And some of those share prices that have maybe rallied a bit on the safe haven bid during the conflict could really get hurt again.
On her Neil de Beer Sunday show yesterday, Chris Stein set the stage for what was supposed to be a fiery debate over the future of Johannesburg. In one corner, the DA's mayoral candidate Helen Ziller. In the other, the Patriotic Alliance's Kenny Kunene. It was just one problem. Only one of them showed up. With an empty chair across from her, Ziller didn't hold back on why she thinks her opponent pulled a last-minute disappearing act.
Helen is here. Kenny is not. Let's go ahead, Helen.
Thank you very much, Chris, for inviting me to this debate. I've never had an online debate before, and you have given me the assurance that it works well. So I was interested to see how it would work in practice and looking forward to this debate with Kenny. But it seems that no one wants to debate me. I mean, Herman Mashaba, I know you asked first and he refused. And Kenny said yes, and I was pleased that he said yes, because the residents of Joburg have every single right to hear what their mayoral candidates have to offer. But unfortunately, he has now reneged at the last minute, as I understand it. And so here we are.
Let me just say there appear to have been some communication problems on the Patriotic Alliance's side, and with Kenny variously not being aware of a debate or it being a deal breaker if I was going to edit the debate in any way, and he now wants a live debate with you.
Well, let's see. I mean, you know, you gave the written assurance that you wouldn't edit the debate in any way that favoured any side, and I took that assurance, and he didn't take that assurance. So, you know, I think they're looking for excuses not to do this debate.
Ellen, if Kenny were here, he might have accused you of being out of touch with your Johannesburg's challenges, that being a reject of Cape Town, and urged you to stay at home and look after your great-grandchildren as he has done before. Any final words for him in absentia?
Well, I'm sure I have got a lot more energy than Kenny Kunene, because I've been all over Joburg all the time and I never see him anyway. I only see him in the nightlife, in the nightclubs, in all the Instagram posts with the slay queens, as they call them, and being arrested at Katie Molefe's place and being associated with the underworld of clubs and nightclubs and DJs that get murdered and having excuses that don't add up, and having investigations, the results of which are never published, but are spread all over as if they are an exoneration, which they're not. He's got a busy life. He's got a busy nightlife. He's got a busy time running around between his different underworld connections and trying to get people not to contradict his statements. That's a busy life. I have a life focused on meeting the people of Joburg, listening to the people of Joburg, listening to their solutions for the problems for Joburg, and getting a plan together to fix Joburg. So I have a busy life doing that. I do see my grandchildren once a month, and I love them dearly. But I can tell you this, the person who's more distracted from all sorts of fundamental roles that he should be playing by his other lives is Kenny Kunene.
Well, the boxing that's going on in Johannesburg even made the FT over the weekend, with news coming out of Treasury that the finance minister will not be bailing Johannesburg out with all its travails financial-wise. Well, thank you for joining us for today's BizNews Daybreak. To stay ahead of the curve and read more from our expert contributors, make sure to visit biznews.com. And of course, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and share it with your network. Now go and seize the day.